Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Corbertson, and I'm remembering to record this intro. And my guest today, I forgot to ask how to pronounce her name, is Robin Schuldenfrei, something like that. Ein bisschen Deutsch, ja? So, Robin, can you tell us a bit about who you are and how you came to study what I would say is Bauhaus, but in the titles of your books, it's always modernism, right? And you can explain why you use the word modernism instead of Bauhaus. So I've already thrown you a curveball. I'll stop talking now. Tell us who you are and we'll go from there.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be on this podcast. And I teach the history of modern architecture and design here in England at the Courtauld, which is part of the University of London. And I work on modernism really as a large sort of concept that encapsulates objects, buildings, but also an ethos. And I'm really interested in broad questions of capitalism, consumption, and the social impact of objects and spaces. So modernism works for me because I'm not just interested in modern objects, but how modernism, really sort of broadly defined, gives both meaning to regular everyday life and also kind of the political agency of objects, that these objects have meaning. They are shaped by society and they shape society. The last part of things that I'm really interested in is the way in which kind of discourses and practices of design are shaped by a period's own cultural and theoretical critique of its media and its objects. So it sounds a little bit meta, but I think it's really important to look at the age on its own terms. And I think you do a really good job of framing that and framing our anarchism in its period, and then how we can understand it today. And I think that gives real relevance to a concept, to objects as well. So I think we have that in common in sort of I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I would think that we would have some shared agreement in how to look at things historically, the value in that, and looking closely at texts in the period. How did they formulate the theory then? And then how we can understand that to have relevance today.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's wonderful. I guess I'll pick up this meta thing. I mean, it seems to me that this is the hardest thing to do. So actually I had John Morrill on the podcast to talk about Cromwell, and he spoke about this problem for a historian, which is your job as a historian is to make sense of the past in its own terms. But the only reason why anyone does that is because they are a living, breathing person in an era who cares about the past for the present. And so the past only in its own terms is useless. The past only in the present's terms is also useless. So you have to have the past in both of these terms, and yet it's also in some paradoxical way not possible to do them both at the same time. So you just try, and I don't know. Benjamin helps here. I find Nietzsche helps here, but I don't need to. I will stop my meta ramblings and just say yes. I agree. You've got to try to take it in its terms and make sense of it in today. And it's not easy. In fact, it's very, very difficult.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think the period I'm talking about is really similar to the world we find each other in today. That is in April 2025, May 2025, with the way things are going historically, could be a completely different period. And so thinking about the 19 teens, the 1920s, with this kind of periods of extreme boom and extreme bust, both in Germany, which we're going to talk about a little bit today, but also in the US, which we'll also get to, then 1930s, the rise of fascism, terrible, terrible wars, and then the kind of post-war period, especially in the U.S. and eventually in Europe, this kind of rampant growth and capitalism, capitalism understood and in some ways. Maybe we should go back to what I would consider the beginnings for the period we're going to talk to today.
Sure, yes, go right ahead.
Well, I think what's really important is to understand the kind of rubble, just really briefly, of World War I. And let's start with the Bauhaus as a school. the tragedy of World War One, the incredible amount of destruction of ecocide, I mean, poisoned earth, poisoned people, shell-shocked people, both the soldiers on the fields, but also everyone taking care of people. And the way in which, when that war ended, there was an impetus for new institutions and new places. And I think the Bauhaus really comes out of that moment. And the Bauhaus is a school that was merged from two previous schools in Weimar, Germany, in 1919. Walter Gropius, a young architect who already had developed a following and important kind of social cachet in terms of thinking about design, architecture, production in this period. And he merges two schools, a traditional sort of Beaux-Arts art school and a school of arts and crafts. And he coins the neologism, which is the school's name, which is Bauhaus. And this name is really essential because the word in German, Bau, relates to building. Bauen is to build, but also it means to grow a crop. And this is really important as well, this kind of growth. House, of course, links to house, housing, this idea. But Bauhütten also links to the Middle Ages and really looking to a guild system rather than the academic tradition is sort of embodied in the ethos of the school. So he wants to kind of start again. And students, he creates a manifesto. It's has a beautiful woodcut, really traditional woodcut, or a woodcut that harks back to the medieval times by Feininger. It's this kind of cathedral, which is glowing. And then he makes a manifesto, very useful in the period for gathering people, and students read about it and they flock to him and to the school. Out of the school, he also wants to break down traditions, to break down what people have known before, the way in which traditional art is made and practiced, and make something that's a lot less hierarchical. He has a really wonderful pedagogic idea of having the preliminary course that everybody has to take, no matter if you've already graduated from art school. You start back at the beginning, you break parts down, you study materials, and then after that first preliminary year, then you go into a workshop system and you learn more specifics, such, you know, in the weaving workshop or the woodworking workshop. And then the smallest circle, the concentric circle, the kind of peak, if it were hierarchical, but you're moving inward and focusing, is architecture. He employs really radical modern artists to teach in his school as the form master. So we get Paul Klee, Wassily Kandinsky, Schlemmer for a stage. And each of these figures is also breaking down the boundaries and the materials and the aesthetics and the theory in their own sub-genres of art. So Joseph Albers, Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, and then he also hires craft masters so you can actually learn metalworking and crafts. But I think, I think that we can talk more about the kinds of objects and how that fits into the ethos, but I think the idea of having a future podcast where we really get into the weeds with these objects and what they mean and how this is also part of everyday anarchy, and the way the school was run was absolutely everyday anarchy. And I've been giving a lot of thought to that. But I think we could maybe take that center of the concentric circle today and consider architecture and how that might work from this period and what happens to these figures thereafter.
So that's all wonderful. That sounds great. I just want to, you know, briefly make the two obvious connections. One, Bauhaus first came up in this podcast in reference to William Morris, and so much of what you said about Gropius and the idea that it's returning to a medieval guild. I mean, first of all, that blows my mind because I tend to sort of try and divide between, you know, progressive leftists and, you know, backwards looking leftists, which these days backwards looking leftists is very unpopular. I love them, but you're supposed to say, literally the word progressive is supposed to be a synonym for leftism. And I don't like that idea. I think, you know, Tesla is a very progressive company, but it's not a leftist company. If progressive means marching into a future, doesn't have to be a good leftist future. The big connection, though, or the big missed connection, is that Morris didn't make a school. that's the thing. And in many ways, Bauhaus sounds more like it has more in common with the work of John Dewey than the work of William Morris when we're thinking about education. And I know that we get Chicago connections. Of course, they loved Dewey at the Black Mountain College. So there's all that. That was a lot. Anything you want to say in response to that quickly before I get to my other question about architecture?
Yeah, I think it's really important that Walter Gropius absolutely looked towards William Morris as the model, and that's absolutely front and center, as a way of negating the Victorians and negating Art Nouveau. So also, not only the ethos of William Morris was really important and the methodology of William Morris, but also trying to distance oneself from the recent past. And so it's really a very cunning, but also wonderful and all-encompassing way to start a school, because what Walter Gropius is also excellent at is PR. The school is open from 1919 to 1933, 14 short years, and yet the productive art and non-productive art, just incredible art and ideas that came from that school in that very, very short time, and that we're talking about its relevance today, is really remarkable. So that's also important. Bauhaus is also an idea. It's a pedagogy, and actually its greatest legacy may be not the aesthetics of a Wassily chair or a metal and glass lamp, but actually this kind of idea, this kind of pedagogy, and how you might educate, continue to educate, and in an iterative fashion. So even up into the early 2000s, when I was a graduate student at the Graduate School of Design, the Architecture School at Harvard, you knew it was fall when the students were sitting up in their architecture studios in day one, folding paper and making things. Mm. That's a pedagogical model that came from Joseph Albers, how you can think about structure from just a thin sheet of regular computer paper. And so, yeah, Bauhaus is a practice. Bauhaus is an idea. Bauhaus is a pedagogy. Its kind of versatility is part of its brilliance. But its connection to architecture might not even be that seemingly relevant, right? There was already the international style of architecture. This is a kind of modern white block. You want to let in lots of light, so it has lots of windows. It's efficient, so the idea of high-rises in a garden, so you don't have your individual garden, but you've got your high-rise in a garden, and then you can enjoy the outside with other members of your community, building inhabitants, maybe a roof garden at the top so you can get sunlight. Of course, modern architecture is coming out of the flu pandemic of 1918, and so all those ideas about ventilation, and sunlight, of course, was seen as very healthy in the period, but of course, fresh air. And all those ideas go back into that kind of architectural style, but also those kind of fundamental architectural ideas. Going into that, though, at the same time is the kind of efficiency, the idea that we are mass producing light bulbs and newspapers and all sorts of other objects in this period. We need to mass produce housing to get people out of the slums of any city, but particularly in cities like Berlin. Farm workers had come into the city because we didn't need them in the countryside anymore. That created a surplus of workers. That wasn't a surplus because there were so many factories, but also office workers. So the rise of kind of clerical workers. If you've got a soap factory and you're sending out invoices for all the soap you're selling, you need also all those kind of clerical workers to just keep the paperwork. And if you've spent any time in Germany, you know, all those folders, they're very organized. You need a whole team of office workers as well as factory workers. So how are you going to house these people, and what's the best way of housing them? In Weimar Germany and at the Bauhaus itself, one idea was to create kind of experimental housing communities. And the idea that you might mass produce small houses, like cookie cutter houses, but in a good way, so that everybody would be housed. And if you could find one prototype, one typological model, and just recreate it, then everybody would be well housed with light and air and a modern kitchen. And so maybe the first piece of architecture we could talk about in that context would be the House and Horn, which is just its location. It was a little house that won a housing competition within the Bauhaus itself. George Mücher was its architect, but then the whole school pitched in to create it. So the woodworking workshop created one of the first comprehensively built-in kitchens. Of course, furniture, metal lamps, even a kind of extendable light, and then other kinds of all the fabrics came out of the weaving workshop. So you have this idea of a kind of planned housing settlement and the idea of a prototype house coming out of the school. Another thing we can talk about, though, is the idea of minimal existence, existence minimum, also in this period. How can we serve the needs of the most number of people with the smallest amount of spaces and resources? Again, not to be cheap and mean, but to take people who are living with live-in lodgers out of the basements with no light, you know, a five family with a husband, a wife, and five children, and then a lodger who sleeps on the kitchen floor. You know, how can we scale up? How can we use modernism and mass production to literally scale up the number of units? And if we do that, what's the minimum number of kind of square meters or square feet to adequately house those people? So that's another idea that's really in the groundwater in the period, with lots of architects working on this project, or this kind of idea. There's conferences about it. So the Bauhaus is not alone. Gropius is not alone on this. Other architects of the period, such as Hannes Meyer, who actually leads the Bauhaus after Gropius leaves the school in 1928. Gropius leaves the school because it feels like his work is done there. He'd rather build. He moves to Berlin, sets up his architecture firm, and is really involved in these kind of large-scale mass housing projects. So Hannes Meyer leads the school, but he's also really interested in this idea of how we provide kind of all the basic needs for people in terms of foodstuffs and housing, a kind of shelter, I might say. And he comes up with this fascinating project called the Co-op Interior. Right away, he's really interested in cooperative living, cooperative supply chains, that you would have co-op grocery stores, so that the idea would be that we feed everyone, not that we make maximum profit on basic elements of life like food. And so his co-op interior is a kind of wonderful project where it's just a single room where it's got foodstuffs and jars on the shelf, so the kind of minimum nourishment needed. He's got a folding chair for seating, of course, for entertainment. He needs his gramophone, which is on also a folding table. So really essential, right? Like, really, how do we live not just with the basic necessities, but a good life? Like, what is a good life in the modern period in the kind of 1920s in Germany? And then a bed. And so you have these kind of ideas of minimum living. And that's where I'd like to introduce Ludwig Hilbersheimer, because he's also working in this period in terms of how can we house people, what's the best way in the city for us to live, and, you know, how this kind of minimum dwelling idea might fit in. So I could elaborate on that, or you could jump in with some questions.
Well, actually, my question was going to be about Hilbersheimer. So I want to go all the way back to the idea that first, let me just say, I didn't know about these designs, this concept of existence minimum, basic existence. I learned about it from your book, and frankly, I was thrilled. I loved it. I was looking at these floor plans and just thinking, you know, we should build these the same way that whenever I look at Frank Lloyd Wright stuff and I'm just like, and, you know, it's like this stuff was never built. I'm like, well, let's build it. Why aren't we building it? So I would love to live in a Bauhaus style existence minimum place. And, you know, the fact that they had, honestly, this is going to take us way further afield, so we shouldn't talk about it, but it reminded me in many ways of Japan. I mean, is there a Japanese influence on Bauhaus? This can be a very short answer, but it looked like kind of, I forget what they call it, like what you see in a ryokan, these sort of traditional rooms. It's very existence minimum.
Yeah absolutely. Gropius particularly was really interested in Japanese culture and Japanese structures. And of course, even in the kind of Art Nouveau period, lots of Japanese objects, these kind of world fairs that would always have a Japan house. So absolutely, the kind of beautiful minimalist simplicity of Japan was very much known and venerated in the period, of course, against the same idea of the sort of over imposition of things of the Victorian period, just those red velvet and all those vases and fussy things and sconces and anti-massacres and the chairs is kind of little coverlets that keep, you know, your chairs tidy and that sort of thing. So absolutely, Japanese design comes into this. But the beauty of the idea of minimalism is that you have what you need and that opens up a space to live, right? And so a lot of people look at the kind of starkness of these interiors or even these buildings, this kind of repetition. And that's one of the points I'm trying to make in the book. This allows a certain kind of freedom that Hilbersheimer, particularly in designing some of these projects, was really looking for the best way that people can be adequately housed, but also to make a good life. And so let me describe, I'll just describe some of these really early projects. We'll start in Berlin in the 1920s. And one of his most radical projects visually is a view of Berlin where he has sliced out the historic core. And in this historic core, he's put this incredible high rise. It's not just high rise housing, which is what it looks like at first. It's actually, the idea of it is that it's workplaces at the bottom and then walkways with shops and everything you might need also right there, and then housing on top. So it's one big block, but actually it's several blocks in this kind of monotonizing, very kind of Brave New World kind of, it's a scary to look at actually, if you don't really know what you're looking at. But he thought, wouldn't it be great if you could just walk downstairs to work, that you had all the amenities that you need, you carve out this kind of old, dark, historic core of the city and provide everything you need. It's the idea of, you know, if you lived here, you'd be home right now when you're stuck on the expressway, right? It's perfect. And so that's where he starts to get these ideas of putting everything you need together within these housing blocks. Now he goes from that idea, this very stark idea of this high-rise city, as he calls it, to the kind of much more planned communities where you have a couple of these high rises. But then if you start to look at these incredible plans a little bit closely, you start to see all these L's, all these L-shaped houses, and they just go on and on and on like a checkerboard. And kind of looking in more closely to that, you see his idea of actually this kind of L-shaped house, but it always has like a tree there also. And this is where his kind of planned single family dwellings come in to play here. So you've got a landscape where you've got trees, you've got greenery, you have high rises, but these high rises are now more designed for young people starting out in life. They want to just live in an apartment, or older couples who've downsized. They've had a couple of kids. Kids are out of the house and they'd rather be in these high rises, but as part of the community. He has nice balconies and he has a view. And then he has these L-shaped houses. And he really comes up with this idea of this single unit, this cell. And from the cell, you build out and you get community. And so you really have this idea of architecture, not in isolation, but in repetition, and really kind of considering the way in which you can relate to kind of social ideas, economic ideas, even psychological conditions. And he tries to create the kind of conditions in a community that will solve some of the problems, such as schools and housing, shops. He always plans a hospital nearby, right? And then also rail lines connecting it all. The other thing he does, particularly when he makes the move to the US, so he has all of these ideas in Chicago and he brings them over when he moves with Mies van der Rohe to Chicago. And they're both working at the Illinois Institute of Technology, IIT. Mies as the head of the architecture department and Hilbersheimer as part of his teaching staff. But really this idea that you would build a community, a settlement that has housing and then also also all the amenities together. And I think it's worth taking a moment and really separating the architecture of Mies van der Rohe from that of Hilbersheimer, because it's political, it's aesthetic, but at first glance, if you kind of Google a Hilbersheimer building, and I'm assuming from this podcast, there'll be a lot of Googling of Ludwig Hilbersheimer.
Let's hope so.
And probably less Googling of Mies van der Rohe. Also Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. And if we think about Mies van der Rohe buildings, he had in the Weimar period, in the Berlin period, very close colleagues worked, as I said, really closely with Hilbersheimer. When he took over from Hannes Meyer from the Bauhaus, Mies became the last director from 1930 to 1933, and it closed down under Mies when the Nazis took over the school. And so when they were both teaching in Dessau at the Bauhaus, again, Mies in charge, Ludwig as one of the most important architecture faculty members, also teaching urban planning and housing there. Then they both go to Chicago. Mies had a lot of really avant-garde projects in Berlin, envisioning these tall steel skyscrapers, these other incredible crystalline glass skyscrapers, many, many, many stories tall, many more stories than any kind of elevator could handle in the period. They were really kind of looking into the future. When Mies gets to America, suddenly he has the kind of ideas that could get built. He moves to Chicago. We already have the kind of birthplace of this skyscraper in Chicago. And Mies gets down to work really quickly. We do have, you know, the late 30s, and then World War II kind of puts a hold on everything. But Mies is also designing small houses, L-shaped houses, courtyard houses is what he calls them. But these are really kind of elite single family houses where you have often a beautiful garage for your very expensive car. You have beautiful woods, actual building, the use of wood. He's got travertine. Many people will be familiar with the Farnsworth house, the weekend house he makes for Edith Farnsworth on the river in the middle of a field in the trees. And it's beautiful, but it's really about using kind of these incredible modern materials of steel and glass, these huge expanses of glass, no matter that the buildings were often very, very hot in the summer and very cold in the winter. But for Mies, he's really using the language of modernism, the excitement of modern materials. And that is part of what he's doing. At the same time, he's got these incredible travertine floors. You have this open plan, and it goes from open plan interior out, extended out to the terrace and sort of into the beyond. So you're really looking at these really elite materials, which is something that I argue about in over in my book, Luxury and Modernism. And we can talk about this when we talk about that book, either later in this podcast or maybe on another occasion. And Mies also has these other ideas of mass producing other glass houses, his 50 by 50, so 50 feet by 50 feet glass house. But if you've got an all glass house, you need a huge lot and you need a beautiful stone wall or some high fences, right? This is anathema to what Hilbersheimer is doing. So I think we can describe Mies as very successful in the U.S. He really gets to a place where he's able to build what he's always envisioned. He's able to work with the capitalist structures very effectively. He makes great friends with developers. He gets his things put through the planning. And so we have incredible tall glass steel buildings that proclaim the new world that is America in the post-war period, with the Lakeshore Drive apartments in Chicago. We've got the Seagram's building on Park Avenue, the sort of stony expanse of Park Avenue. And suddenly Mies gets his incredible steel and glass building there. But we can go back to Hilbersheimer in his vision for the city, for Chicago, because Chicago ought to be the perfect place for Hilbersheimer to realize his vision. It's already got a grid. It's got the perfect Jeffersonian grid. You would think that he would just be able to also get building and give everybody what they need and in terms of these communities. And so I guess a question I wanted to ask is the grid anarchic? what is anarchic about a grid? It's completely confining. It's very sterile. It's very sort of logical. It doesn't really set up the kind of everyday experience that might be embodied by the idea of everyday anarchism. But I really think that, in fact, the grid is really anarchic, and I think it really provides a framework for community, for meeting needs such as fresh food, for housing, of course, for public transit. And then people can do what they want. They can be in nature. They can get out to nature. If you've got a grid with its replicatable cells in that grid, so the grid that Hilbersheimer is really envisioning, whether it's a high rise where the cells stack on top of each other, or it's all these little L-shaped houses with these little tiny yards, but also expanding out, you can then respond to human needs and a kind of humanist vision. These are not the tools of a functionalist architect. Actually, these are the tools of a kind of real humanism who's really given thought about what to do in terms of giving people kind of a life. There's really famously at IIT something called Hibbs Day. And this is every year since Hibbs taught there on around the 21st of December, you know, the deepest, darkest day. And what he always wanted students to do is design so that their building optimally functions on the darkest day of the year. And I think that's really telling, because when you see these skyscrapers and these designs from Hilbersheimer and other modernists, you don't necessarily think, that's not the first thing that goes to mind if you think you're going to be in Unit 675, right? But that's really where he's coming from. And then within these kind of high rise and then, well, you could call it sprawl if it was going to be limitless. And he never thought of the Chicago grid as kind of sprawling out and out and out. He really had this idea, and I think this is a really important distinction, of this idea of a settlement, a new city. And that is a sort of bounded condition. And then another new city. This is really important in the atomic age. It was a really scary period when you've got hydrogen bombs and the idea that you need to build a future for them. Well, it fits quite well with Hilbersheimer's ideas, because he actually plotted out if a bomb hit Chicago, how many people would die versus if you start actually expanding these settlements into the landscape. And gave everybody what they needed in these kind of communities. But it's in, and you can think about how perfect this is for the Midwest particularly, because you could have these cities with light industry first, and then more heavy industry, and then agricultural work. And even there, he comes up with this really wonderful idea that agricultural workers could supplement their income in the off season with factory work or some kind of more heavy industry or light industry kind of work, and vice versa. Factory workers might actually want to get out in the fresh air and do some farm work, maybe in their own gardens or maybe in the kind of landscape. And so this becomes really important, but it's also great in the Cold War, this idea of a community, but also with this kind of housing. And he does lots of work with traffic and how you can put these houses together in cul-de-sacs so that you don't get through traffic. Because he talks a lot about the danger of the speeding automobile. And I think back actually to Andy Warhol and his car crash paintings, or silkscreens, I guess they're paintings. And newspapers used to really published these graphic images of car crashes, which is what Andy Warhol used as his material for it. And I think that really struck Hilbersheimer, coming from, you know, Berlin, but also Dessau, the speeding automobile in a community designed for children. So he has all these cul-de-sacs and then streets leading. And his ideal is maybe just having four intersections and that everybody can walk within 15 to 20 minutes to where they need to be. They can also get on well-connecting public transit and rail lines. But in the center is a community center and a school. So, of course, the children just walk to the community center and the school. And so I think this is, again, where everyday anarchism fits in and the way we can sort of start to understand the grid as an anarchic construction, if you're conceiving of it in the right way.
That was the chapter when I was reading that I thought this is the chapter that, I mean, I'd already emailed you before I read the book, just from reading about the book, wanting to have you on the show. But that's the chapter. And I've just been working on this for so long. I've just been working on this for so long. The question of the grid and how we are to understand it, and how we are to understand the relationship between architecture, planning, traffic, and what I would call, I mean, what I would call life, right? So there's this problem. I mean, or the problem I've been confronting for, gosh, now I've been working on this for almost two decades, is there is a great tradition. And it seems to me that, like, Mies van der Rohe and Le Corbusier, I can never say that name quite properly. And of course, you know, I've been to East Berlin, and you can see it there. And there's Red Vienna, which is like, let's build this housing. It's socialist housing, and we can give everyone everything they need. And then, of course, the housing projects now in the United States, some of which were, if not designed by people like Mies and Le Corbusier, modeled on them. And those, I think I'm willing to say, I mean, and I can say this, especially since I'm not a Marxist or a supporter of the USSR or the DDR or anything, those were bad. They were failures. They were not alive. They were dead. And you can disagree with me in a second, but I'm going to finish my thing first. And then the other thing is this living, breathing thing called sprawl, or the grid, which seems quite anarchic and quickly chokes itself and becomes the bad anarchy of laissez-faire capitalism. And I have been looking for my entire career for models. The best one I have found, of course, is Ebenezer Howard's Garden Cities, famously Jane Jacobs. And the most famous book written in the United States, at least, about this, says, you know, the grid will eventually provide this harmony. It just takes time. And I mean, she's very anarchist. I don't think she uses that word. And in very few places, and your chapter on Hilbersheimer is one of them, there's Barcelona's super blocks. It's like, how do we have both of these things? How can we have a big plan that will provide people what they need, but we don't turn it into a desert that is barren of life? A very recent one is they are building outside of Tehran, these deserts, these enormous complexes that provide vitally needed housing for this very large and wonderful city who has been, you know, choked by U.S. sanctions. And so they're building housing that people need, but there's nowhere to live there. There's somewhere to sleep, but there's nowhere to live.
There.
Yes. And when I got to Hilbersheimer's plan of how you can fuse these together, I just got so excited, because it's anyone who has spent 5 minutes anywhere can tell whether they're in one of those dead places or one of those places that's been choked by capitalism and children can't be on the street because they're going to be run over, or those few places, those very few places, often in old world capitals, you know, old world cities, because we don't tend to build them anymore, where it is both planned and has what people need and is alive all at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely crucial, because you have to build the infrastructure, which is what he's doing with his grid, but he's thinking through it at the same time about community life, right? And he writes about this idea of organic community life so that democracy could prevail and each individual could be a participant in community activities. And so his thinking of a scale that is actually specifically talks about it needs to be big enough to maintain communal life, cultural and hygienic institutions. I think he's thinking of hospitals and things. And big enough to distribute goods, right? It's no good if you have to drive 20 miles to go to the grocery store, right? So you have to think about this life and this community. Some of these buildings do work from the period. So if you think about perhaps one of Le Corbusier's high rises in Marseille, where on the roof of the building, the communal roof, is the nursery school for the building's inhabitants. And the pictures are so joyous, with children in these little paddling pools with these beautiful sculptural concrete, well, beautiful to me as an architectural historian, if you like that kind of concrete aesthetic. But, you know, the beauty of the splashing water and the children out playing on the roof with the breezes coming across, right? You think about daycare centers, right? And the germs and, you know, the safety protocols in the hallways versus, you know, your kids are running wild on the roof of high rise. It's kind of radical in and of itself. But these things only work. They only work if you are putting everything into it. So maintenance and care of the building, these communities do work. If you do also, for instance, the Barbican in London, right? If you've got a community which protects things, which keeps things alive, where there's traditions within the building that you build community, it's not just enough to build enough units. Otherwise, we'd build our way out of problems. I mean, capitalism could step into that and solve that problem. So what's the difference between Ebenezer Howard's Garden City and urban sprawl, right? Is there's a there, and around it is usually nature. And if you think about just property value, a terrible tool to measure anything, but name a garden city where the houses aren't more expensive than the norm almost anywhere else, right? You want to live in garden cities. The original ones in England are still incredible places to live. I was certainly priced out of anything like that when I moved here. And so what's really interesting also about Hilbersheimer's kind of overall vision is also the way in which he does all these studies to see which way the winds would blow with the factories. So he's really thinking about health, right? Also, but also you don't want noxious fumes. I mean, think of Chicago in this period. It's absolutely a huge industrial place with these huge smokestacks. And so he's really thinking about these kind of qualities of life that kids can cross the street safely on the way to school, the traffic safety, this idea of being able to downsize and stay in your apartment, this kind of idea, but also this kind of overall life and health of the community. And I think that's where modernism can solve problems, but it can't solve all the problems. And other kinds of architecture can probably do that. In England, they're trying to make these new communities, bring people, and then connect them. But the problem is that they've built the community, but they haven't built the infrastructure. They haven't built the grocery stores. There's one craft beer bar, but there's not enough scale to have more than one bar. And if you don't drink, there's like not, you know, it's not quite enough for the farmer's market, right? You need a certain scale. And I think your episode on the farmer's market was really, really helpful to think about how you need to build not a massive farmer's market, but of course, lots of little farmer's markets that move around. And I think that's really important, and it feeds into this idea of community. And the place I think where this works the best is where where Hilbersheimer is working with Mies, and that's Lafayette Park, which is not in Chicago, but in Detroit. And this is a huge tract of land. It had been called Black Bottom. There's a lot of disposition of poor African-American citizens there. And so that kind of history of it, it's very much acknowledged and problematic about our urban past, and particularly that community. But that's a wonderful project built with the backing of a developer, where you get Mies's steel and glass vision with these kind of skyscraper buildings, and then lots of low-level individual housing and townhouses. And so there's a whole mixture of appropriate for various budgets. Some were rental, some where you could buy, but set in this kind of amazing parkland landscape by Alfred Caldwell, who worked with them and worked with others in Chicago on landscape design and modern landscape design and how to create these kind of communities. And that that project works really well. It works really well today because these trees are now very, very old and beautiful and leafy. With the kind of back to the city movement, people have moved back, young families. It's very popular to live. Of course, architects teaching at the University of Michigan love teaching there, living in Mies and Hilbersheimer settlement and then commuting to work. But just other people, lawyers and just regular people in the community who've bought or bought into this development. So I think, yeah, these projects can really work, but I think the idea of community and community becomes these spaces of everyday anarchy. You have citizens groups which sort of control things in some of these buildings, right? Because preservation is important. And I think we could have a future conversation about where building and creating enough for everybody intersects with preservation, because we have to remember that William Morris was the beginner. He founded the Society for the Protection of Ancient Monuments in England because he saw so much destruction of historic old buildings. And I think that connection to new architecture and a kind of shared past through architecture can really give people meaning. And I think that's also the problem between sprawl and these new developments that have sort of meaning to them. Sometimes they're actually attached to older but smaller communities. And so they provide a kind of infrastructure, and you know, more trains will then go more regularly, which means you can work still in this sort of usually the urban environment and then commute out to them. And so that becomes important too.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're heading towards the end of our time and we can be very relaxed because we'll just record again. But my question now, and maybe this is a question for the luxury and modernism conversation. It certainly is my question about Howard's Garden Cities, which I've never gotten quite an answer to, which is, you know, we're sitting here between 50 to 100 years later after this stuff, and we look back on it and we think, gosh, wouldn't it be nice if it was just everywhere? So why isn't it everywhere? If everyone loves all of Howard's Garden Cities, why did they stop building them? Which you don't have to answer that question. But if this vision of life, and this is where the luxury part, these things now are for rich people. Modern housing, modern architecture is for rich people. What happened, Robin? Why did we end up with the sprawl that we have? Do we blame Eisenhower in the United States? I mean, what happened?
Yeah, exactly. You can blame a lot of people. You definitely need to think about having some expert on your show about property development and its ramifications, mostly for cities, but also, of course, all the government programs and who they would give mortgages to and the kind of redlining that separated communities, and also preservation, right? If you had put preservation orders on all of those row houses in Chicago that they wiped out to make high rises, which they've now torn down and are building, making row houses again, and having mixed economic communities, right? With a couple of, you know, especially Chicago. Chicagoland's great for this. You've got the Gilded Age mansions, which I think we both have interests in the Gilded Age period, me from an architectural standpoint and what's happening when capital turns into physical architecture, and you from political and lots of other ramifications. But I think we can think about this kind of mixed communities, right? We can think about preservation and we can think about ways in which people got things right and then we tried to do something else and that didn't work. And so I think government policy is really important. The way in which it's easier also today, I'm seeing the effect of this terribly in England, even under the Labour government, and maybe even particularly, they're just doubling down on giving everybody a house. So the idea that everybody gets their tiny house with their little garden, but without the kind of buy-in, because this is being outsourced to private developers. So you don't have the idea of having public services buying in to create the infrastructure that you need this to make this a success. It's much easier to take a couple of fields and create from zero a lot of cookie cutter housing. Here it's adorable because it has kind of little tile roofs and this kind of idea from William Morris, right? And your postage stamp lawn. But it's the same problem as, you know, American fake siding, tract houses too big there. But here you could also, there's plenty of housing. People will argue, I want my children to live in the community, and particularly a housing project that I fought in my own village in England and spectacularly failed. What people said is, oh, but I want my children to live in the community. There are so many adorable cottages that are absolutely affordable. Criminally affordable, really. Actually, I think the idea of, you know, giving tax breaks to take housing, to fix things up, right? The fixer upper is not quite the same thing here. Young family, they just want their brilliantly new open planned kitchen with their beautiful new bathrooms. And with this model of housing, you have a huge problem when you leave your housing to developers. And when you, where are the housing theorists today? Where is Ebenezer Howard? He's turning over in his grave, I guess, is what he's doing right now. But you can't outsource that kind of thinking. The government can't outsource it. It can't privatize it. I think, you know, we don't have the kind of thinking like Hilbersheimer necessarily today. Although, of course, there's architects and architecture schools, you know, putting out people who would love to step up and help. But I think we need something like an infrastructure or a cohesive ethos, right? Again, back to the farmer's market. You only need a couple of people who are really interested in doing that work. And that volunteer community is really important because it does give people, different kinds of people who have different kinds of expertise coming together on an urban project. One of the things that worked really well for me, even though I completely lost this fight for this 200 houses in my little village, was out of the woodwork, the people who think the same way about our landscape, our community. One of the huge problems is school districts here are just done by distance to the school. And if you live too far away, it's not like if you live in the town of Evanston, you get to go to Evanston schools because you've bought into that community, problematic in and of itself, but kind of rest assured. Here, if you've got a big bubble of kids, they will say anyone who lives 500 meters from the school gets in. Oh, this year it's 600 meters. You don't even know. So one of the problems of putting this new housing development right next to the school, which is great for the kids who live there, is that the children on the other half of our village across the bridge, they don't get into the catchment area anymore. And they have to go to a different one, different school in a different village, one village over. And they also don't provide school busing. You've never seen a yellow school bus in England.
I learned that recently, actually.
You're on your own getting your kid to school, right? And so that's the problem about outsourcing community, outsourcing responsibility for our built environment. We need a buy-in. It doesn't necessarily need to be the government structures we have today, but we need a structure. We need people thinking about it. And I think that's what's so interesting in thinking about 1920s Germany and what they were doing, what they were genuinely trying to address a need. And they were using capitalism as the tool that they had at their, but then also thinking about other ways, socialism, communism, of course, all of the anarchists also thinking about ways in which things can be organized. I think that's really important, and it allows us to both connect to our period, but also see the disconnect, that we can understand this period and what the goals were. It might be different from the aesthetic of what you see when you see one of these high rises. You may see one of the amazing, I find them absolutely incredible images. Hilbersheimer's drawings are in the Art Institute of Chicago, and in real life, they are just enormous and incredible. I've tried to have them reproduced really at the maximum scale. My publisher was absolutely wonderful about this in the book to be able to really see it. But I think there is something there to this period that really fascinates me and that we can continue to learn from.
Yeah, I think just briefly, and listeners might be sick of hearing about this, but the primary villain for me until Trump showed up was these goddamn Ezra Klein, Matthew Iglesias, center leftists who are always explaining that the only answer to everything is the market. And they just published this new book. So this will be the 17th mention of this new book, Abundance, which basically they said it's Derek Thompson and Ezra Klein. And they just said, we've got a problem. We don't have enough housing. And the problem is that local communities are blocking developers from building housing. And the idea that we need more housing, I can sign up to that. But the idea that the developers are the answer, not community supported, community directed, that the idea that you would have a vision for the housing in your community is now treated. So that's why I started nodding vigorously when you mentioned, you know, the neo-Blair government that you have now. Is like, of course, the idea that you would dream of a better life, not a better life, the idea that you would dream of a better community and work towards making that, as opposed to just saying, you know what, the real problem is the people who want a better community because they're blocking the developers.
You're never going to build your way out of the housing problem. You're never going to build your way out of it. It's so interesting. I was in Chicago and living in Evanston in the early 2000s. And that boom for Evanston, for people who don't know, it's a really old garden suburb kind of idea. You can get to Chicago on light rail really quickly, which was great for me when I was teaching at University of Illinois at Chicago. But it was also had a huge conservation and historic area. Those conservation areas are also a product of the 60s and 70s when homeowners said, hold on a minute, these beautiful old homes of amazing, made of amazing materials and wood. We need to preserve some of this. And not only the biggest, boldest houses along the lakefront, right, which is capitalism exerting itself in a prior boom from the 1890s in Chicago, but also smaller houses. And in Evanston, though, you know, it was losing somewhat of population, and it had this kind of sleepy downtown, really charming, you know, diners and mom and pop shops that are institutions, you know, the shoe store that had been there already for 50 years and was still in the same family. And one of the solutions was the kind of condoization of the downtown of Chicago. And on one hand, good. I mean, the environmental impact, I think we cannot lose sight of. You've already got a town that's got really good connectivity to a city. And if we build some high rises, some condos, we can kind of build our way out of some of our tax problems, especially when you've got a massive school such as Northeastern only giving some money in lieu of taxes. But of course, these nonprofit institutions create, you know, a wonderful place to live with book readings and free lectures and things like that. But they create their own problems with property taxes when you've got a system built on property taxes, which I've heard you, I'm very much in agreement with your ideas on that. Interestingly enough, in England, you pay property taxes when you buy and then never again. So that's interesting when you hold something for hundreds of years and the crown owns a huge percentage, which I should have at my fingertips because it's so shocking, but I don't. Definitely Google it if you're in the mood for a shock of how much the royal family owns in terms of land in the UK. But in Evanston and many, many other communities, this idea is that you could condo your way out of the problem, right? Because retirees will come to the community for the culture and the restaurants and the walk to the lake, and they'll give us all this taxes and they won't put children in the school. But as soon as you start to build condos, you create a whole other problem. You know, can your firemen put out a fire on the top of that building? It's not as cheap as it first appears. And so I completely agree. We need to have real thinking, and what we're doing right now isn't working. And just kind of building and buying your way out of our problems is just got such a huge environmental impact alone, right? I mean, we should not be building really any more buildings without stopping and thinking about what we can preserve, what we can renovate. And really the kind of concrete is just, you know, the worst material ever. We're actually, you know, taking down a concrete building, it has huge ramifications for the environment and the kind of materiality of life. And so I think really in this kind of time is really a moment to really stop and think about new ways of being, being political, being in one's community and doing things because what we're doing now isn't working on so many levels. And I think the impact on children, you know, we both teach at the university and kind of we don't quite know what the mental health sort of crisis of our period, we don't know where it's coming from. But there's a way in which, and there's a whole lot of problems with the heteronormative 1950s and 1960s, but there's also something there. There is something about communities and fabric and connectedness to people that's the kind of everyday anarchy that both the kind of friction and I don't agree with a lot of my neighbors in the village, obviously, with this development, but the ones I strongly agree with, I only had the opportunity by putting huge amounts of labor into that fight. And that was the ultimate win for me. Of course, now I have to walk my dog a different way around so that I can't see it, because in fact, the rendering we did about what it was going to look like and how horrible it was going to be with the vista was exactly 100% on. It does look like that. But it has brought wonderful children into the community, liveliness. And the other thing it's brought into our really kind of white heteronormative English village is people from other cultures, right? New immigrants who are, this is their starter home. And we didn't have necessarily those people in this little English village. And so there's a lot of, there's silver linings and even the kind of housing I don't want to see. Our village also floods. It didn't have any permeable pavers. We asked nothing of the developers, nothing. We said, here is our village and our land. Make as much money as you want from it. So that's not the way I think to move forward. Ezra Klein could come and visit. I would love to have a conversation with him. It'd be great if he'd like take his show on the road to sort of obscure places. Yeah, I think it's important to really think about where we're going and how we're going and how the history of the past and also the kind of theorization, the formulation. Hilbersheimer wrote huge amounts. He was mostly writing and then teaching. He also was a wonderful teacher. There's famous stories. At IIT, Crown Hall was the modern building that Mies made, which is mostly just glass and steel. It's just a glass and steel skyscraper. A glass and steel structure. But there's these famous stories of Hilbersheimer. He used to run the building like a sailboat, opening the windows and getting the cross breezes because only a few of the windows open, right? But he could just run and basically sail the building. And I think that's a beautiful image if you think of the kind of steel and glass Mies kinds of buildings. We all know what they look like, right? But then how do you live in them? How do you make them livable? Now, of course, it's climate controlled. But I love the idea of Hilbersheimer darting around early morning. And that's really the way to run a building, right? My house is 300 years old because modernists, you know, also enjoy really old buildings. And in the summer, it will keep the cool much more than any one of those brand new buildings that have been built in my village, because it has thick walls and you put the curtains, you close the curtains like in Italy, and then you open them back up and put the breezes in. And Hilbersheimer absolutely knew that. And so I think that's also sort of a corollary to Hibbs Day and getting the max amount of sunlight, but also how you ventilate your buildings.
Okay. This has been wonderful, Robin. I do have to just say, I mean, we talked for a while, but any last thing you want to add before we go?
No, I think it's just really important for people. What I really like about your podcast is it really creates these opportunities to think about everyday anarchism in their own way and in their own lives. And I think that's going to be the kind of tipping point of the community, at least firstly of listeners to your podcast. I would really like you to get a book on this out ASAP. And I suggest something like Penguin for $5.99. ASAP and cheap, because I think there's what I think people should do is like look into their own lives and their own communities, wherever those communities are. And I really hope that your listener base, I'm sure you've got some really interesting places from which people do tune in through their own networks. And I think there's a lot of ways where people can use their own expertise, whatever that expertise is, and kind of put that back. And I think these times call for it. It's exactly this moment, Trump, April 2025. We don't know what the future holds. We know what the past has been. And I think really the moment now is to think anew. This is a real opportunity because what we're doing is not working.
Yeah, I think I don't have any publishers interested, I should say that. But I think you're right. And I think that we've learned from the past few months in the States that we all feel like there's nothing we can do. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, this is something I'm very vocal about. That's how they want you to feel. I was going to say something that sounds very conspiratorial, but they is the elites whoever you want to say. I understand we're two university professors, but if you read people like Ezra Klein, you know, one of the things that they are very upset about is that the people are unruly, you know, and are not following rules. Yes, messy.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, who wants you quiet and complacent and letting the developers do what they want to do? It's not the right wingers. I mean, it is, but it's not only the right wingers. It's the entire professional class of governors. They want us governed. And of course, one response to this, like, that was that stupid movie, V for Vendetta. One response to this is put on a mask and burn it all down. And that's what people think when they think of anarchy. But meeting your neighbors and talking about what you want the community to be, not what Derek Thompson says your community has to be because he crunched the numbers and knows our only choice, that's what we need. And to pull it back one more time, I didn't think that you could find this in Bauhaus, a movement which I have admired its design, but been, you know, fairly unknowledgeable about for one thing, but also, you know, been worried about the elitist or luxury aspect of it. And damn, I did this by accident, but let's talk about the luxury problem and Bauhaus. Soon enough.
I want to leave you just with two quotes, just a famous pithy one so people will know. Of course, Mies famously said, less is more, right? Mm-hmm. And then Robert Venturi, with Complexity and Contradiction, really important urban tract, said less is a bore, and that we want that both and. We want that messy reality. And so, let's just leave on that architectural note, and we'll talk about Bauhaus and objects and capitalism and luxury and modernism on another time.
All right. Thank you so much, Robin.
Thank you.